Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, your intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. My name is Fred Flights, sitting in for your usual host, Frank Gaffney. We have a lot to talk about today, but I wanted to start by discussing the situation with the Iran nuclear deal. There's been some interesting developments this week. They have occurred in conjunction with President Trump's fabulous speech to the UN General Assembly, in which he called this agreement, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, an embarrassment to the United States. Well, it's interesting that yesterday, September 20th, there were press reports that said that President Trump has decided what he's going to do about this agreement. Now, here's the deal. The nuclear agreement with Iran is not signed. It's not a treaty, even though it was ratified as a treaty by the Iranian parliament. The U.S. Senate was not allowed to perform its constitutional duty to ratify this agreement like it should have. Basically, this is an agreement that went around the U.S. Congress. It is an executive agreement at best that can be canceled by the president at any time. Now, under the Corker-Cardin Act, the president is required every 90 days to certify to Congress that this agreement is in the national security interests of the United States and that Iran is in compliance. Now, the president made this certification in April and in July, and he's scheduled to make the next certification on October 15th. Now, each time he made the certification, the president did so extremely reluctantly because his advisors were concerned that pulling out of the agreement would upset our European allies, an argument that Mr. Trump didn't take kindly to. But they also argued that we have to come up with alternatives and we are engaged in a policy review. It's amazing that here we are, October 2017, and this policy review it has not been completed yet. You see, my view is that Iran is an urgent national security threat, and when I was at the CIA, we could have finished a policy review of Iran in less than a week. Why this review is not finished? Of course, the reason is that the people who want to stay in this terrible agreement, they don't want a decision that would take us out. So the president made it clear when he made his last certification that he wasn't going to do it again. Now, in response to that, Ambassador John Bolton, my former boss, was tasked by former Trump advisor Steve Bannon to come up with an alternative on how to get the United States out of this dangerous agreement. And Bolton wrote this plan. But as I've discussed on this program, when he was about to present it to the president, Mr. Bannon had been removed the week before, the president's senior advisors would not let Mr. Bolton meet with the president to present this important plan. Mr. Bolton was told to meet with Secretary Tillerson. So Ambassador Bolton published his plan in the Wall Street Journal, and I'm fairly certain the president is aware of it. And basically, Bolton's view is that this is just a dangerous agreement because it allows Iran to continue its pursuit of nuclear weapons since it can continue enriching uranium with over 5,000 centrifuge machines while the deal's in effect. The verification provisions of this agreement are very, very weak. And it excludes so many things that really are vital to addressing the threat from Iran. Its ballistic missile program, which are a delivery system for nuclear weapons. Its sponsorship of terrorism. Its efforts to destabilize the Middle East. Iran's behavior has gotten significantly worse since this agreement was announced. Iran sent troops into Syria after this agreement was announced. It really has emboldened Iran to behave even worse. So it's sort of amusing that Iranian officials condemned the president and threatened consequences after the president's General Assembly speech and if the United States pulls out of this nuclear agreement. Basically, they're threatening that they're going to behave very badly if we pull out of this agreement. But they're already behaving badly. They're already engaging in bellicose and belligerent activities that really are unacceptable. Remember, on the day of President Obama's last State of the Union address, Iran took U.S. sailors hostage and held them for hostage until the day after the address. This was after it received over $1 billion in sanctions relief and plane loads of cash secretly flown from Switzerland to Iran to free Americans that Iran was holding as hostages. Well, Ambassador Bolton's view is that this deal is not salvageable. Iran is not going to agree to change it. Iran is not going to agree to give up all the concessions it received from the Obama administration. He therefore has another plan. And his idea is that we have to have a comprehensive approach to Iran that deals with all the threats from Iran. We have to do it in conjunction with our Middle East allies. You know, this nuclear deal with Iran had no input from Israel or the Gulf states. They were stunned at the concessions made by the last administration to get this agreement. And we know that John Kerry would give Iran anything to get this legacy foreign policy achievement for Barack Obama. Now, there are some in Washington, and I regret there's some people who call themselves conservatives. They do not want us to get out of the agreement because they're worried about offending the Europeans. They're saying, well, you know, the U.S. has given its word. My view is the U.S. does not have to abide by a commitment to an agreement that is a fraud. But since the president said he's going to withdraw, they've tried to come up with another strategy. And here's the strategy. The president won't certify the deal to Congress. He'll invite Congress to take action. But we won't get out of the deal. We'll work to fix the deal over several years. Now, I've discussed this with Ambassador Bolton, and frankly, it makes him pretty angry. This proposal, which is being put forward by a number of reputable organizations, is a fraud because Iran will never agree to change the agreement. And any attempt by Congress to implement sanctions lifted under the agreement that would threaten the continuation of the agreement will be filibustered by Senate Democrats. This is just an attempt to give the president an opportunity to make a grand announcement of being tough on Iran, but not getting out of this fraudulent agreement. And consider this. If this agreement is so terrible and so awful, as the people who advocate this approach are saying, we shouldn't be in it. If it's an agreement that's not in U.S. national security interest, if it's a fraud, we should leave the agreement. And some people say, well, our European allies won't be with us. Jay Solomon is a former Wall Street Journal reporter who wrote a book about the Iran deal negotiations. He details how John Kerry and U.S. diplomats twisted the arms of their European counterparts, who were very uncomfortable with all the concessions that were made to get this deal. And he specifically talks about how the U.S. delegation under Kerry berated and ridiculed French diplomats for not supporting the concessions that Kerry wanted to make to get this deal. So I think that our diplomats, Trump diplomats, have to say to the Europeans, you knew this was a bad agreement. You shouldn't have gone along with it. And you knew you were complicit in a scheme to do an end run around the U.S. Constitution. So don't complain to us that we're being unilateral, that we're not consulting with you. You shouldn't have agreed to this. You knew this was a bad agreement. That's the approach that I really would suggest. There are many efforts right now to create the impression that there are alternatives to pulling out of the agreement. These stories are being pushed very aggressively by National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Tillerson seems to be particularly committed to keeping the United States in the agreement. But I got to tell you, I know McMaster is too, and my hope is McMaster will be gone very soon because I don't think he is promoting President Trump's foreign policy vision, the vision that he campaigned on. Well, Trump has to make a decision soon. Supposedly, this decision will be made before the 15th of October. He says he's made a decision, but we don't know what that is. I'm proud to say that the Center for Security Policy today circulated a letter by 45 national security experts and flag officers urging President Trump to withdraw from this terrible agreement using the Bolton Plan. You can find it on our website, securefreedom.org. Well, I'm going to wrap up there and go to our first guest, Elizabeth Savidich Wolf. This is Fred Flights, substituting for Frank Gaffney on Secure Freedom Radio. Stay tuned.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, your intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. My name is Fred Flights. I'm a senior vice president with the Center for Security Policy, sitting in for your usual host, Frank Gaffney. We have a special guest today who is going to speak on challenges of free speech in Europe and Austria. Her name is Elizabeth Savidich Wolf. She is an advisor to the board of a German human rights non-governmental organization. She has worked in diplomatic positions for the government of Austria. And last year, she was charged with denigration of religious beliefs for supposedly insulting Islam in the state of Austria. And if she's convicted, she'll have to pay a fine of 480 euros. And it looks like her conviction has been held up by a higher court, and she could possibly face time in jail. Elizabeth, thank you for being here today, and I'd like you to tell us about your story.
My story, yes. Well, I actually have to update you because I've already paid the 480 euros, unfortunately, very grudgingly I did. The case is currently pending at the European Court of Human Rights and has been pending for about 5 years now. And it looks, but this is my personal opinion, it looks like the court is holding back the decision, which has probably already been made, because of the situation in Europe. It wouldn't look good if Austria were to lose the case and I were to win for freedom of speech.
Now, you call yourself an Austrian anti-jihad and anti-Sharia activist. Is that correct?
I'm a free speech activist. That goes without saying that I'm also opposed to Sharia, because Sharia infringes on our very rights to freedom of speech and all the other freedoms that are associated with freedom of speech.
What have you said that would require the Austrian government to take legal action against you?
I hold the conviction that Muhammad isn't the perfect human being that Muslims believe he is. And I didn't like the way he, how shall I phrase it? I'm sitting in Austria, so I don't want to get in trouble again. You know, that he married a six-year-old girl and consummated the marriage at the age of nine. And the court said that this is I'm denigrating the religious beliefs of so many Muslims, and this is unacceptable. And I can't call a spade a spade. Let's leave it at that, since I'm currently on Austrian territory.
You know, I've been to Austria many times, and it's really sad to hear you say that you're afraid to speak freely in a free country like Austria on an issue like this. And what you're saying is not that controversial. There are many historians who have said the same thing. I mean, this, to call this hate speech, this is something else. This is a form of censorship that we're seeing at the OSCE and in the United Nations. Is that your take on this?
Absolutely, especially at the OSCE, where I, along with many other colleagues, and I must add, very brave colleagues, are in an open battle we're fighting for freedom of speech, we're fighting for freedom of conscience, for freedom of association, basically for the Bill of Rights. That's what we're fighting for. And having just returned from the latest forum in Warsaw, I can tell you that the situation has deteriorated even further, and it is only due to the OSCE's own commitments that we are still allowed to participate in this forum. We were told quite clearly and openly that the OSCE would like to do nothing more than to kick us out and basically take away our right to speak.
Well, my Center for Security Policy colleagues were with you in Warsaw, and that is exactly their reaction. But it's interesting that there actually are rules within the OSCE, although the OSCE leaders may not want to admit it, that are dedicated to protecting free speech and the democratic system. So it's just amazing what you just said, what my colleagues said, that this is an organization that does not want to defend these values.
You see, the values have changed, okay? What we call freedom of speech, or what the OSCE commitments call freedom of speech, is no longer what freedom of speech was once seen as. You have to understand, when the OSCE was founded back at the height of the Cold War in 1975, which, you know, the CSCE emerged from the Helsinki Accords, where for the first time the Soviets sat down to talk about these issues, about freedom of religion and freedom of speech. I mean, before that, it was unheard of, unthinkable, that the Soviets would even discuss these matters. So you have a completely different take on what freedom of speech is today. It's always freedom of speech, but, and you know as well as I do, once you have a freedom of speech, but, there is no true freedom of speech anymore, because you have a caveat, and there's freedom of speech, but you can't say this. Freedom of speech, but, you know, the law says something different. But you have to be tolerant. But you have to be non-discriminatory. Freedom of speech, but, is not freedom of speech. It's for the freedom of speech to listen to former President Obama's different speeches and Sunday talks. I don't need freedom of speech for that. I need freedom of speech for the controversial speech, for the speech that makes you think, for the speech that you may not like. Freedom of speech means freedom of speech, period. Okay? And if I may quote Mark Stein, who said, hate speech is free speech. That's what it's for.
Of course, that's right. And it's interesting that the OSCE is an organization that the West used to counter a totalitarian threat, Soviet communism, the threat from the Soviet Union during the Cold War. But now it seems like it is yielding to another totalitarian threat, Sharia and the global jihad movement. And to silence voices of freedom and democracy in this world. Let me turn to another question. Could you talk briefly about, in Austria, what is going on concerning Sharia and other efforts to basically make concessions to Islamists who would like to impose a different form of government and way of life on the Austrian people?
Well, if you're asking me if Sharia is already present in Austrian society, I can tell you, yes, absolutely, it's here. I can tell you that the Islamization is moving forward. I can give you a very concrete example. I live in a very affluent area without being affluent myself. And not only do we have about 1,000 so-called refugees, asylum seekers, housed in one of the former hospitals, basically around the corner from where I live, but we have two Turkish supermarkets that have been opened and established only in the last couple of months. And I'm wondering why, in an area where there were no Sharia-compliant men and women present, do we all of a sudden need a Sharia-compliant halal supermarket? Two of them, as a matter of fact.
Well, Elizabeth Savinich-Wolf, we have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much for offering us your analysis today, and good luck with your heroic efforts to defend free speech in Europe and in Austria. Next up, Claudia Rosette will discuss President Trump's speech to the UN General Assembly and the threat from North Korea. Stay tuned.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. My next guest is Claudia Rosette. She is one of the brightest experts I know on national security, and I'm also proud to call her a friend. She is an American writer and journalist, a blogger at PJ Media's Rosette Report. She is a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum and a foreign affairs columnist at Forbes.com. You'll see her publications published everywhere, including in the Wall Street Journal and at Forbes.com. Claudia, welcome.
Thank you very much, Fred. Great to be here.
Well, Claudia, we have a lot to talk about. I'd like in this first segment to discuss President Trump's speech to the UN General Assembly. I might add that Claudia is well known for expertise in the United Nations. And then I want to focus on another area of your expertise, and that is North Korea. So to start out with, just give us your impressions about President Trump's first speech to the UN General Assembly.
It was terrific. He went in and in a forum where they're really not used to hearing things, the truth told or the truth told in direct words. He said quite a number of things that I think that it was very good for that assembly to hear. And he laid out a number of things that it was very important for them to know, or at least understand or begin to appreciate. America, during the Obama administration, lost a tremendous amount of credibility as far as being believable when it said, you shouldn't do things, don't do that. Beyond that, President Obama was in favor of a lot of things that really weren't workable, not in this world. And when President Trump went in today, I think my impression is what he's doing, it has arrested the very bad trajectory that we were on. And he's now saying things that said sort of a point in a very different direction. Basically, it was terrific. He went into the UN General Assembly chamber and told the truth, Fred. Do you know how rare that is? So bottom line, there are things you can criticize in the speech. I'm happy to. But he also, on really major points, I think got it absolutely right on what he said about North Korea, about Iran, about Venezuela, about socialism and communism. I'm happy to go into any of those. When he called Kim Jong-un Rocket Man, I greatly prefer that to calling Kim Jong-un Excellency or Supreme Leader. Rocket Man is just fine. Kim Jong-un does not deserve respect. He's the leader of a totalitarian state that has been doing monstrous things to its own people for years, is now threatening us with the nuclear weapons it's making in violation of 9 UN sanctions resolutions. And I was especially grateful that President Trump mentioned Otto Warmbier, the American student who was basically killed by North Korea, but returned home in the last final days, effectively brain dead, to die here. It was terrible, and it's something America should not forget.
Well, this is a president who went into a diplomatic forum, which is notorious for its diplomatic niceties and for making grand statements that say nothing. And this president went to the General Assembly and called the nuclear deal with Iran an embarrassment to the United States. Made it clear of how concerned he is about how Iranian behavior has gotten worse since this agreement was announced, in addition to what he said about North Korea. How do you think the president's presentation was received by other nations and by the delegates at the UN?
There was, polite applause, not effusive. There was certainly no standing ovation. I think that it probably left a lot of them thinking, what exactly to make of this. I can tell you for sure how it was received by the American press in the main, because we can read that right there. And they were shocked and appalled. Within hours, the Washington Post was writing about Trump's menacing speech. The New York Times was writing that he was giving a confrontational speech, and so on. I would set that aside. I think there's great concern there that the American president, by telling the truth, might upset assorted dictatorships that sit on the General Assembly. I'm not really worried about that. I think that's fine. As far as what the UN membership makes of it, one of their big concerns, of course, is that they just want American money coming into the United Nations. And Trump, in talking about reforming the UN, has been threatening to withhold some of that. They're kind of worried about that. Then there are the member states that he specifically called out, Iran, North Korea. Iran is now demanding an apology for his speech, which is very funny. So they've reverted to their classic, actually the Iranian sort of propaganda approach, which I think is put together by Iranian officials who studied in America, studied us, and basically mimic the worst aspects of the U.S. press in what they feed back. They feed it back to the press. It's sort of like the Ben Rhodes echo chamber, only it's coming from Iran. North Korea left a note taker, had front row seats, and left it. They boycotted the speech, leaving a note taker for it. That's just fine with me. We can move on to this later. I think they should actually just be expelled from the UN. But they probably are thinking, because here's the tricky thing. What President Trump said was clear. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for his regime if he continues down this path. That's probably true, because if they really do attack us, we are going to end up in a war, a hot war. We're officially at war with them now, but a hot war. And that could be very terrible. But what Trump has to do, if he's going to have any chance of averting that, is convince North Korea that he's serious when he threatens that he'll do that.
Okay, I want to get to North Korea in the next segment. Let me move to a one final question in this segment. What I was surprised about the speech is that, you know, the president didn't write the UN off. He seems like he's prepared to work with it if it will change its ways and implement reform. Is that your impression?
Yeah, and I thought when he first came in that there was some chance he might actually look and he might approach the UN with the view that we really don't need this institution. It does more harm than good. That's my own view. If you actually total up, what is it that the UN contributes to the well-being of not the world and America in particular, I think on balance it's dangerous. It's a forum that serves as a gathering place, a club, for some of the worst influences and players in the world, and we pay for it. Trump has not done that. What he appears to have done instead is decided, okay, I'm stuck with this, we're going to work with it. That's very much what came across in his speech today. You know, he thanked Russia and China for signing on to North Korea's sanctions resolutions. Well, they've been doing that for years and violating them. They don't need thanking. He was talking about this idea of sovereignty, which I think he hasn't quite worked out. I'm not quite sure exactly what it is he means. Dan Hanninger has a good column on this today in the Wall Street Journal, mentioning this. But basically, the way it came across to me is he was saying, "You don't threaten us, we won't bother you," which is a good message to be sending anywhere at this point, given the number of rising dangers in the world. But yeah, he is apparently trying to work through the UN. I think that's going to have its downside. At the same time, he may well have decided that in trying to allocate his political capital, the heavy lift that would be required to actually get the US out of the UN or do something about the UN, which is really entrenched, is better spent elsewhere.
Chloe Rosette, I'm afraid we have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much for offering your analysis of the UN General Assembly speech by President Trump. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Affney. We'll be right back.
to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. My name is Fred Flights with the Center for Security Policy, substituting for Frank Gaffney on Secure Freedom Radio. My guest is Claudia Rosette, who is a well-known expert on North Korea. And given all the developments going on with North Korea today, Claudia, I'm really enthusiastic about having an opportunity to discuss this with you, starting with your new Wall Street Journal op-ed titled, Kick North Korea Out of the UN. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is something where if you actually think the UN Charter matters in the least, it should be an obvious move. And the UN has, since 2006, has been slathering sanctions on North Korea. We now have 9 sanctions resolutions. North Korea has carried right on with its nuclear tests and ballistic missile tests and its threats and its monstrous oppression of its people. The point I was trying to make is if the idea is before we end up in a hot war, let's try every diplomatic avenue that might help do something. There's a strong case simply on the part of the UN, or as far as anyone who thinks the UN is worth trying to treat reasonably in any way or treat as an institution with any integrity at all. There's a case that simply out of respect for the UN Charter, North Korea should be thrown out of the UN. It never met the requirements for membership. It was a latecomer. It was admitted in tandem with South Korea in 1991 as the Soviet Union was falling apart. And the rationalization at the time, this was horse trading between Russia and the U.S. with their vetoes on the Security Council. And the rationalization at the time was North Korea brought into the U.N. fold with its patron collapsing, the Soviet Union, might reform. You know, this would be a way to just civilize everything. Of course, that didn't work out at all. North Korea immediately began exploiting its membership in the UN. And in less than 2 years, it had already become a problem brought before the Security Council over its nuclear program, which was back then found to be out of compliance with nuclear safeguards. If you actually look at the UN Charter, North Korea is in violation of the Charter. I mean, so are about half the members of the UN. But if we start somewhere with that problem, North Korea stands out as candidate number one for expel this country. It doesn't belong there, and which might have the beneficial effect of taking away the effective legitimacy conferred on the North Korean regime when the UN gave it a seat. Also, if the UN Security Council wants countries to isolate North Korea and cut off dealings with it, surely the UN itself should start by showing here's how it's done. All they need to do is a recommendation from the Security Council, a vote of the General Assembly, and I think the arguments for it are so solid. North Korea is in violation of the Charter. It is a country that's now in violation of the stack of UN sanctions as well. And its own abuses of its people are so monstrously at odds with the founding principles of the UN. In other words, complete breach of the Charter and the qualifications for membership.
Well, I want to move on to the recent UN Security Council resolution passed in response to the detonation of a supposed H-bomb earlier this month. And as you know, the UN yet again passed the toughest sanctions ever against North Korea to increase the pain on the North Korean regime. And I think you wrote a column recently expressing skepticism at this latest claim that the international community is really getting tough with the North. Give us your take on this.
Yeah, well, we've been watching one sanctions resolution after another passed for years because that's the default mode. Every time, they're of course described as the toughest ever because every time they are. The problem is increment after increment has not succeeded in actually stopping the North Korean nuclear program. In fact, sanctions don't stop nuclear programs. They do. They may have other effects. They can target specific actors. They can effectively impose a cost on the targets or the target country. But the things that have stopped nuclear programs, Fred, are regime change in the Israeli Air Force. that's about it. Because the case of Gaddafi giving up his nuclear kit was his fear of suffering the fate of Saddam Hussein, who had just been overthrown in Iraq, because we suspected he had was working again on nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction. So the problem is with sanctions. From the economic point of view, I think you get to a stage of diminishing returns. You know, you can keep on adding more sanctions, but unless they're actually enforced, it doesn't make a great deal of difference. And Russia and China have never fully enforced the same sanctions that they have approved every resolution at the UN since this started with this batch of sanctions resolutions in 2006. So it's kind of like saying we're going to make a stronger and stronger sieve. Yes, but things are still getting through. And what is the end game? Again, where have these the tough sanctions regimes, where have they taken us in the cases of Iran and North Korea, these two major problem proliferators in the modern world? Incredibly bad deals. A rotten Iran nuclear deal that the Trump administration will scrap, that President Obama sold under false pretenses and through all sorts of manipulation, and did an end run around the U.S. Congress to get the U.N. to pass before the Congress could even debate it, and a series of rotten nuclear deals with North Korea, on which North Korea has cheated, and they're now testing not only atomic weapons, but apparently the hydrogen bomb.
Let me ask you a related question. I mean, the sanctions clearly have a lot of holes in them, but China has gone further than it has before. There's reports that China actually was concerned about radiation drifting over the border after the last reported H-bomb test. Where is China right now? What do you expect China to do next?
I think that if you look at how China has behaved for years, China seems to me to be okay with the idea of North Korea getting nuclear weapons, because North Korea threatens us. It's not making threats to nuke Beijing, you'll notice, and it's unlikely that they would try. They would be obliterated. China doesn't go through the sorts of democratic debate, open discussion, and so on that we do, or for that matter, moral compunction over various things. I think a certain amount of what we read, there may be real dismay. I mean, for people living near the North Korean border, that's got to be a real concern in China. And at the same time, I think China is a great deal less dismayed than its official pronouncements would suggest. And I put Russia in much the same box. I think these are two significant powers that are right there in the neighborhood. They both have borders with North Korea.
So how do you think the Chinese view the Trump administration's approach to North Korea and Trump's warnings to Pyongyang?
Fred, I wish I knew for sure, but my guess would be that they're trying very hard right now to figure out how serious he is and what abilities he has to follow through, not only military, but political. On the ground. I mean, an American leader has to rally the American people. And in that sense, it may be if he's going to prepare for any sort of serious military action, it's a good idea to have the support of the American voters behind you and to explain to them why and what you're doing. A day that will live in infamy. Pearl Harbor made it obvious, but you don't really want to wait to that point if you can manage to do something first. And in that sense, which takes us back to President Trump's UN speech, it's a good thing that he's talking the way he is, that he's speaking plainly, that he's not talking about, as President Obama did, strategic patience. Words must mean something when they meant nothing. To be pointing out that what North Korea is doing is very dangerous, very wrong, and that they will be totally destroyed if they attack us, I think that's a useful thing that people across America, as well as around the world, can look at, think about, and it's time America really did pay attention to North Korea, not as a joke, a comedy movie, or anything else, but as a really virulent, malign, and increasingly, unfortunately, well-armed threat.
Cloyta Rosette, I'm afraid we have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much for offering your analysis of the UN General Assembly speech by President Trump and the threat from North Korea. And thank you for listening today to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Fred Flights, sitting in for Frank Gaffney.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.